From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're taking an intimate look at the life and music of Igor Stravinsky. Igor Stravinsky was a challenging god of 20th century musical composition. He famously made shocked audiences rage and flee. He had a chameleon-like quality, an ability to borrow from every source around him, from highbrow to low, a unique, unsettling grasp of rhythm and harmony, and a rebel's readiness to puncture tradition. All that made him quintessentially modern and globally revered and feared. Less well known is that the great Russian exile composer was intensely superstitious, an insatiable workhorse, and a lover of all things American, from Hollywood to Looney Tunes. Our guest tonight, Robert Kraft, knew Igor Stravinsky with astonishing intimacy. An accomplished conductor in his own right, Kraft's 23-year relationship with Stravinsky stamped both their lives. From their first meeting in 1948 until Stravinsky's death in 1971, Robert Kraft served as Igor Stravinsky's musical sounding board, his co-conductor, his traveling companion, intellectual stimulus, and most of all, good friend. With Stravinsky, he wrote 7 books and traversed the heart of a century. Robert Kraft's latest book, An Improbable Life, is the autobiography of a rare and rarefied relationship. We caught up recently with Robert Kraft and his unparalleled memories of a composer who shook the world, Igor Stravinsky. Robert Kraft, welcome to On Point.
I thank you.
you've been racing from interview to interview, from meeting to meeting, and we're delighted to have you with us.
This is the grand finale, actually, this afternoon.
We're thrilled to have it. It's been such a pleasure diving into your books and having, for me personally, this world of Stravinsky revealed in a way that I never had begun to understand. I guess no one had the intimacy that you had with this composer. Take us back. Who were you when you first heard Stravinsky? How did the boy in upstate New York, the young man, and the czarist-era composer make a connection?
Lots of crossroads. Mm-hmm. I think the first performance I ever heard of Firebird, I must have been 8 or 9, was conducted by Jose Iturbe at Rochester Philharmonic. And I was thrilled by it. And I got a hold of the few records of Stravinsky available at the time. And I can remember my mother telling me, please don't play that anymore. That's a Sacre du Printemps or Les Noces. So just shrieking and dissonance and so on. To the family, though my family were musical.
But even at that, lots of musical people in the early 20th century were practically jumping out windows to escape Stravinsky's work. What was it about you, Robert Kraft, that drew you to it? Firebird Suite, maybe we understand it's still related to the kind of romantic sounds of traditional music, but when you go to The Rite of Spring, we're into some real dissonance and some real blaring fugal horns. What brought you to want to play that when your mother was pulling your hair out?
Certainly, The Rite of Spring changed the history of music, as I think no other piece by anybody in the 20th century. It's all different. The music we hear in film scores is stolen from Petrushka, The Rite of Spring, or watered-down versions of this music. There was something in my nature which was akin to Stravinsky's nature. Stravinsky had a doctor at MIT called Max Reinkel, who became mixed up in LSD and experiments of Huxley's Doors of Perception.
Huxley, who was also part of Stravinsky's circle later.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. But I started speaking with this doctor who examined both of us, Stravinsky and myself, one day here in Boston in 1949. And he said we had exactly the same reflexes. So I felt this rhythmic music of Stravinsky that turned me on, but I had the same sense about it that he did. He saw this in me. When I first met him, I rehearsed for him. We had a concert together in April 1948. Mm. He conducted the first half, I conducted the second half. he had never conducted with another conductor mm-hmm. before, and I was only 23. He saw me rehearse the music and understood his pieces as well as mine, that I did know the letter of the music and I had knew the spirit of the music.
Was there something about pathos that connected you? You write very candidly about how you had been sent off to military school, you hated it, you took refuge in music, you're drafted into the into the military in World War II, you end up downing a bottle of aspirin in New Orleans in despair at the kind of Philistine, soulless world that circumstances had brought you to, and only music and Juilliard and maybe Stravinsky ultimately brought you out of that. But was there something shared there that made you rise up to the dissonance of Stravinsky?
From that background, I always kept the music in mind. I had scores with me, even throughout the entire war. But it goes back much before that. It was when I was really quite young, about six, and I spent my time not reading the school books at all, but reading gigantic amounts of Russian literature.
And so incredibly, here, the young man, the boy, in upstate New York, is absorbing all of this, at many points in Russian, laying the foundation to become the Bosworth to the Stravinsky's Johnson, as you've been described sometimes, Robert Kraft. We want to hear all about this relationship, but set the big frame for us as we go into it. For much of the 20th century, later, Stravinsky was referred to as the great composer of the 20th century. First, why was that? And secondly, now as we're tiptoeing into the 21st century, does he still stand with that same stature?
To work backwards, the stature has changed, but the popularity has grown. Mm-hmm. His late music is, of course, difficult to understand and difficult for audiences and difficult to play. However, now, Agon is his most popular ballet, not the Firebird. And
most performed now is Agon.
Most performed. And it's the Balanchine's version has been copied.
And this is his last ballet.
It's his last ballet.
Was it about Stravinsky for so much of that century that made people say, there he is, difficult to listen to perhaps, but the greatest composer of our century? What was it?
There's a tremendous variety in the music to begin with. It's in every form, every medium. He wrote a television play. He wrote religious music, secular music. He wrote concerti, symphonies, not a tremendous amount of chamber music, but it was all new and original. Every piece is very different from every other. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it is quite possible to make good programs of Stravinsky's music, and it's done now more than ever. I see all the statements, the royalty statements and things on this. Mm-hmm. So I can say this with some confidence that nobody else has the number of pieces from unexpected countries in Eastern Europe. Now, of course, it's catching on in Russia.
So that's the volume, and that's the frequency at which he's played.
Yes.
But you're one of his greatest interpreters. Take us inside the music. What is it about the music itself that led people to lay this label on Stravinsky, the greatest?
He's in contrast to all other composers in that his music is very happy. There is a lightness of spirit, even in
Help me. I'm still thinking of the Rites of Spring and having a little trouble with that.
That isn't all that happy. But it is joyful in the rhythm. The
verve is tremendous, even when it's dark.
Always. And he moved with the times. Whereas, for example, Schoenberg came to the United States bringing Vienna with him. Mm-hmm. Stravinsky did not bring Russia with him. He adapted. He wanted to learn American ways, American orchestras. And being a conductor, he traveled around. He picked up a lot of American sayings and language. But he wanted to be, and had made up his mind in 1942, that he was going to be an American, would not go back to Europe.
Why did he end up coming to the States in the early 40s? And describe your first meeting with him.
I'll try to do that. He came to the United States in 1940 to do the Elliot Norton lectures at Harvard. Mm-hmm. His finances were very poor. His music was banned in Germany from, well, probably 1933.
Because?
Well, I mean, all new things were banned in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And he was top of the list, together with Schoenberg. I wrote to Stravinsky in February 1944. I was 20 years of age, and I sent a letter asking for some music of his, a score of the Symphonies of Wind Instruments, which I regard as one of his greatest masterpieces. And that's another big turning point in his life.
What was it about that piece that so captured you?
Oh, it has that elemental power of The Rite of Spring. It is a marvelous concision of form, use of instruments, tremendous compression. It's finished with long introductions like The Rite of Spring. He didn't do that anymore.
Your first actual meeting with Stravinsky was on the same day that he received the libretto for the opera he was working on at that time, the Rake's Progress.
Yes. Auden delivered the libretto, and I delivered myself.
And he needed you. He was a Russian emigre in Los Angeles already at that time? Not much English?
He needed me, yes. He saw from our concert together in 1948... that I did know his music and could be useful to him as strictly as a musician by rehearsing for him, co-conducting. And he saw from this meeting, it was a three-way meeting with W.H. Auden and Stravinsky myself, that Stravinsky was always asking, comment dire ça en anglais? Is there an idiomatic term for some French term? And he asked Auden, well, Auden is anti-French. And I jumped in on some occasions, and Stravinsky saw that I could talk to Auden. I mean, I wasn't terrified of him. I had been to his lectures, and I knew him a little bit.
As young as you were ready to,
yes,
to have that conversation.
And so Stravinsky immediately saw, when he started to read the libretto, the finished libretto of the Rake, that I could be useful to him, that I could help him with questions of accent and pronunciation, and even dramatic questions. And the way he composed would be to write a line of the libretto and in musical notation without pitches. But he did that all his life.
Well, you could write
a note and put a line with a flag giving the rhythm. But he sometimes set the rhythms before he set any pitches to them.
We'll talk more with Robert Kraft after a short break. This is I Go to Him from Igor Stravinsky's opera, The Rake's Progress. I'm Tom Asborough. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Stravinsky this hour with one of his great confidants, Robert Kraft, whose new book, An Improbable Life, is a sort of autobiography of their shared years. This is Fireworks, written in 1908. It's one of Stravinsky's earliest works. I know you worked with Stravinsky in the last 30 years of his life, but your conversations with him, recorded in many volumes, are famous. Take us back for a moment, if you would, to his childhood in Russia. He later wrote that it was something he wanted to send it all to hell. Was it a happy childhood or not?
I think it was extremely unhappy. He was terrified of his father. Mm-hmm. His father seems to have ignored him completely. He was the third of the four children. There was a huge age differences between the eldest of the four sons.
And this was in St. Petersburg?
In St. Petersburg. Stravinsky had never been to Moscow until 1962. Oh,
when you traveled with him, and yes. We'll talk about that later. Yes.
But he was more brought up by an East Prussian nurse who taught him what Hans Werner Henze once told me was a very Baltic version of German, not absolutely clear, though I had seen Stravinsky conduct all over Europe. And used German
to converse?
He used German, he used French. His Italian was less good, but he did know it. It's his versatility in language is one of the most astonishing thing about him. He compiled a Russian-English dictionary after his first two or three tours in this country. He decided he's going to learn English. And he wrote a marvelous little dictionary. It's the definitions and the pronunciation guides. Mm. We invented a whole system.
Russian English in Stravinsky's
uses the Spanish sign, the borrowing from all languages. Mm-hmm. I learned however much French I speak still from him, because he tried to get me to speak French so he could continue to speak to his wife in Russian, and I wouldn't understand. He did not want me to learn Russian. But, of course, it was inevitable that sitting in a car with them, and he was giving instructions, starozhna, he would say to his wife who was driving, which means look out.
And you would learn.
And so I learned.
His family left Russia several years before the overthrow of the Tsar. Why?
Well, Stravinsky's success, his greatest achievements, all happened in Paris. And he regarded Rimsky-Korsakov, his teacher, mm-hmm. Rimsky's children, that is, as attacking him in Petrushka, which actually Andrei Rimsky-Korsakov said is Russian vodka mixed with French perfume. They turned on Stravinsky, and he wanted to be away from him. All of Stravinsky's other pupils, like Scriabin, like Prokofiev, they turned against Stravinsky. And he was also ill, and his first wife had tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And they found, right after the premiere of Firebird in June 1910, they moved, not thinking it would be permanent, to Switzerland. And he went back only once or twice after that time, again in 1911, just before the premiere of Petrushka, and then in 1913, the autumn of 1913, never went back.
And yet, as even they described in Petrushka, the stamp of Russian vodka and French perfume. Yeah. Talk about the Russian quality of Stravinsky's music. Was it always there? Did it diminish over time as he lived his global life?
It certainly diminished, though he was also nostalgic and wrote little Russian pieces. What would have been of interest, rather than this marvelous scholastic tome that we have by Richard Taruskin, the Russian Stravinsky, would be the Russian elements in Stravinsky's later music, which have nothing to do with his Russian period. Mm. For example, Persephone and Oedipus Rex are both very Russian, not perhaps as Russian as Les Nos, but Oedipus Rex, melody after melody, rhythms, they are still Russian.
Hey, year would that have been composed?
That was 1927.
Oh, and he would, at that time, have been living, was he still in France or in England?
He was in France then. England does not loom very large in Stravinsky's life. And he always said that if 10% of the general musical public is with him, at least interested and sympathetic to his music and willing to listen, it was only 7% in London.
A lower ratio. Robert Kraft, I wish you'd take one of his early works. You choose Firebird, Suite, Petrushka, Rite of Spring, the works that made him initially famous, and break down for us, help us think through what it was about any one of these that you choose that put Stravinsky so gigantically on the map.
Well, certainly Firebird is the piece that put him on the map. The first performance was reviewed in the front page as a news event of the New York Herald Tribune. That's June 26, you probably find it, in 1910.
Because the response had been so
amazing.
Where was it first performed?
In Paris. Henry James was in the audience. Everybody was in the audience. You know that story. I won't go through this long list of the celebrated people, but part of that was the beauty of the set designs and the marvelous, vibrant colors of costumes.
Was this considered Russian Orientalism at the time?
Orientalism at the time, yes. Mm-hmm. What Stravinsky said with some derogatory intent, Russian export. Mm-hmm. It's made for export.
But the music itself, then, what did he see himself as exploiting that same kind of exotica?
He criticized himself thereafter, and he changed totally. Firebird is, put it very primitively, Firebird is written with the heart on sleeve, with feelings on sleeve. Mm-hmm. After that, he's holding his sleeve, he's got control of his emotions as he did for the rest of his life.
It's mastery over emotion.
Mastery over his feelings. He didn't let his feelings spill over. There's no sentimentality, certainly. And well, maybe there is a little in Petrushka, but it's of a different kind. Firebird is sentimental.
Seeing everyone in that Paris audience, Henry James and all the rest, were swept up in the kind of exotic Russian Orientalism, or was there something structurally revolutionary about this piece of music? Something in the harmonics, in the rhythm, in the...
All together. It is, I would say, the new thing in Firebird is still the blatant, direct-on dissonances that you get in Kastchi's dance. Mm-hmm. But it also... I mean, this syncopation throughout, the changing of meters, the proportional system of related tempos, and maybe above all, the color. For the first time in Firebird, he's using a trombone trill. The trombone's never trilled in Wagner or Brahms. They tried to play.
That's difficult to do. I played trombone as a youth. It's hard to trill a trombone.
And these great swoops that the French horns did, and what really the open notes,
yes,
which is throughout the Danse Sacrale and throughout the Second du Printemps. But he was doing that in the Firebird, and these orchestral effects were tremendously interesting for the French school. Himself had really followed Debussy. Debussy was his hero, and I don't know, perhaps you can compare the opening of L'Après-midi en Faune with the opening of Sacre du Printemps, a solo instrument, bassoon in Stravinsky's case and flute in Debussy's, and it goes on for some time. And but of course, Afternoon of the Faun is a gentle, sweet, amorous piece, and Stravinsky's is savage.
Put that passage from the Firebird Suite and the kind of romanticism, emotionality, even exoticism that he associated with that.
Yeah.
Take us through biographically to the point at which he's now composing in a more disciplined or mastered way, as you say, The Rite of Spring. What was going on in his life? Was it a matter of life events or simply his growth as a musician and composer?
But one can't leave out the political side, because mm-hmm. it's after The Nightingale, which follows the Sacre du Printemps, but never equaled it in its effect. But then came the war. He is deprived of his language. He can't use it in his music anymore.
He's cut off from Russia by war and revolution. What year was Rite of Spring written?
Rite of Spring is the end of 1911 through the spring of 1913.
Mm-hmm. So it's anticipating.
It's anticipating the war. Actually, there used to be a saying that it really started the war because the reception of it was so radical.
Remind us of that reception. I mean, we've heard the story a million times, but to tell us again, where did it debut and what was the response?
First of all, a film has been made of that, a French film in 1923. They tried to reproduce every bit of evidence, the accounts of everybody who had been present, and the entire French intellectual world was at its peak then. Mm-hmm. I mean, the painters, the artists of every kind. Stravinsky himself was very angry about the reception, because he wasn't expecting it.
This is the rejection, the outrage.
The outrage. And he wrote that on the surviving original score, which is now in Switzerland. On the last page, I will not ever forgive the French public for the way they treated me in this piece. It took him completely by surprise. I can't understand that, because it has knocked out everybody else, so it's still... If you haven't heard it, and it's possible anymore to hear the Sacre du Printemps for the first time, you're going to be quite shocked. But he took it as something totally unexpected, because it had dress rehearsals, and there had been cheering, and all the musicians who were there were tremendously interested in it.
But when it hit the big audience, wow, what a pushback. And it is so fascinating to look at moments like that, when a new figure, a new form comes on the scene, yes, that people find absolutely outrageous. They run screaming from the theater, and there at those moments history turns.
Yeah.
Robert Kraft, it's so such a rare opportunity to talk with you. Step up out of the music with us for a moment and help us understand how this great composer, with his Russian background, with all of his years in Europe, adapted to life in Los Angeles. He never intended to stay, but he did. What was his relationship with the United States, with Los Angeles?
He liked it so much. Consider that he'd had these three very ill family members for a long time. Here he was alone on a second marriage with a woman with whom he'd been living and was in love with for 50 years. And he was so happy to be alone living in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles then was a livable city. There were no tall buildings because there had been mm-hmm. terrible earthquakes in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And it was quite empty. I mean, you could see Charlie Chaplin's house up at the Sunset Boulevard or Hollywood Boulevard, I don't remember which, and empty properties around. You could drive from his home to Malibu Beach in about 15 minutes,
was
which takes 3 hours. Now.
Yes. Was he living the gilded life? Was he part of the Hollywood moneyed set? Or what were his circumstances in L.A.?
Well, this was an intellectual world then. Thomas Mann said it was far more intellectual city than Munich had ever been, and a more interesting city than Paris in the 30s.
So who was he consorting with?
He was consorting with the free French, the free British, Isherwood, Huxley, there's so many more, but mm-hmm. people like Jean Renoir, for example, mm-hmm. was a very close friend. And the Germans, he saw a lot of Thomas Mann and Bert Brecht even. He admired these people. Many Italian refugees. It was an entirely refugee city. Mm-hmm. And the cream of the intellectual America at that time is something that we owe to Nazi Germany.
Because they were all driven out.
They were all driven out.
But for all that, you write that Stravinsky loved the cinema, that he was watching a couple of movies every week. He loved cowboy films, gangster films.
He loved
cartoons, Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes, yes. No, Stravinsky liked American life. He liked the openness of it. He did not like the old snobbery of the people you meet in Proust. He didn't like Proust himself, actually, but he found it difficult to go to these endless receptions in Paris. There are photographs of him where he's making terrible faces at a sitting with the Noailles, the Polignacs.
But so cowboy films and Looney Tunes were a kind of a
relief.
Fresh air to him.
Fresh air, absolutely. He loved life. And also another thing, he had tuberculosis, and he had it when he died.
In 1971.
Yes. But it can be dormant, and it was during all of his American years. But he can drink in the clean air of Los Angeles and feel more healthy than he'd ever felt. He had no serious illness in those first years in California.
We'll talk more with Robert Kraft after a short break. Let's go into it listening to Stravinsky's Circus Polka, written in 1942 for the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Stravinsky this hour with the composer's great American confidant, Robert Kraft, whose new book, An Improbable Life, is a sort of autobiography of a life shared with genius. This is one of Igor Stravinsky's greatest religious compositions, Symphony of Psalms. Same years that many of these years that you knew Stravinsky, he was writing out of religion, or somehow religiosity was very much at work in his music. Was he a religious man? Did he think about religion? What's your understanding of the relationship between religion and music for Igor Stravinsky?
Religion was came before ballets. He chose to compose the Canticum Sacrum and Threnody, which is the Lamentations of Jeremiah. The biblical works are numerous. The late pieces, Symphony of Psalms, which was composed for the Boston Symphony. And these, he would give preference to composing on religious texts.
Dedicated to the glory of God. There's no pulling the punch here.
No pulling the punch. Other pieces.
For such a modernist.
Yeah. That baffled me very much. I'm much less good at my Mahayana Buddhism. But
when the religious welled up in him, when in his composing, was it a different Stravinsky, or was it the same modernist at work pushing that envelope forward?
There's a tremendous austerity in every one of his religious works. And there's a difference, but he could switch from one to another very quickly. Mm-hmm. And of course, he welcomed commissions because he liked specific demands. I mean, he liked to be told this piece has to be between 18 and 20 minutes for an orchestra not larger than this or that. He liked measurements and liked to follow them and come out right. He always said, by the way, about his music, he said, I love much more composing music than I do listen to it. Hmm. However, I like to listen because I have to be sure that I was right. That he didn't care anymore. Right. I was right.
Get it right. Take us into his house in Los Angeles. What was the living environment of Stravinsky there?
It was full of brilliant colors, Russian colors. Paintings, had a dozen paintings, great paintings by Picasso at one time, which all had to be sold. And he had paintings by all of the great painters. Mm-hmm. Hirako, I consider a very great painter, Giacometti. His home was full of Russian objects, family utensils, vases, silver. He had a big collection of silver. Didn't like gold, he liked silver. Hmm.
But for most of his life, he would be outraged, you write, even at the mention of the Soviet Union. He was absolutely,
yes,
did not want to hear about it, did not want to talk about it. And then in 1962, after so many years of blocking out and pushing it away, he returned. You were with him. I was reading through Orlando Feig's new book, Natasha's Dances, Cultural History of Russia. Great compendium, getting enormous, wonderful reviews. And here, at the climax of the book, come you, Robert Kraft, and Stravinsky, on this visit to Russia. And I guess you must have taken down the speech that he gave after everyone had had their vodka, and as you say, everyone's Russianness was coming out and everyone, yes, was out-Russianing the next.
That's just what happened.
And Stravinsky gave this speech, and I wondered if you'd be good enough to just read it for us. 1962, Igor Stravinsky, the Metropole Hotel in Moscow, seated alongside the great Shostakovich.
One of the quintessentially Russian events, which are punctuated by a regular succession of increasingly expansive vodka toasts. And soon, as Kraft recalled, the room was turned into a Finnish bath in whose vapors everyone, proclaiming and acclaiming each other's Russianness, says almost the same thing. Again and again, each one abases himself before the mystery of their Russianness. And so, I realize with a shock, does Stravinsky, whose replies are soon overtaking the toasts. In a perfectly sober speech, he was the least alcoholically elevated of anyone in the room, because he drank a lot. He was used to it. Stravinsky proclaimed, "The smell of the Russian earth is different, and such things are impossible to forget. A man has one birthplace, one fatherland, one country. He can have only one country, and the place of his birth is the more important factor in his life. I regret the circumstances separated me from my fatherland, that I did not give birth to my works here, and, above all, that I was not here to help the new Soviet Union create its new music." I believe that's true. At that moment, anyway, he certainly felt that. Mm. I did not leave Russia of my own will, even though I dislike much in my Russia, and in Russia generally. That means he can criticize it, but nobody else can. Yet the right to criticize Russia is mine because Russia is mine because I love it, and I do not give any foreigner that right. It's exactly what he said, which I took down under the table.
We're glad you were there, Robert Kraft, in 1962 and over all those years. Robert Kraft, it's our great good luck that you were there to interpret Stravinsky and to bring the history that surrounds this composition to all of us here today. And I want to thank you for being with us. It's been just terrific.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very touched.
Robert Kraft's two latest books on Stravinsky are An Improbable Life and Memories and Commentaries, Igor Stravinsky and Robert Kraft. Let's close the show with Igor Stravinsky's Sanctus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We are prepared to receive the inspectors within the assigned timetable. We are eager to see them perform their duties in accordance with international law as soon as possible.
Today I received a letter from the Iraqi government accepting the resolution, saying that they would work with the resolution, and Mr. Blix and his team will go back. We expect them to get there on the 18th and actively begin their work.
Zero tolerance, about as plain as I can make it. We will not tolerate any deception, denial, or deceit, period.
Why should fear, killing, destruction, displacement, orphaning, and widowing continue to be our lot, while security, stability, and happiness be your lot? This is unfair. It is time that we get even.
Whoever put this tape out has put the world on notice yet again that we're at war and that we need to take these messages very seriously, and we will.
I'm troubled that we haven't found bin Laden in all this time, and I think it really causes many of us to be concerned about whether or not we are winning the war on terror.
We have a lot of challenges. Our work isn't done. But thank God we are where we are today. We're in a much better place than we were 10 months ago. And these norms are an exceedingly significant step for us to take.
We are convinced that guided and inspired by the spirit of the 16th Party Congress, the Chinese Communist Party will further project its fine image before the world as a party that advances with the times in a pioneering spirit.
I didn't run as a woman. I ran again as a seasoned politician and experienced legislator. It just so happens that I am a woman, and we have been waiting a long time for this moment.
And there's a week, Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations announces that Saddam Hussein will bow to the Security Council resolution and welcome UN weapons inspectors back into Iraq. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is pleased with that decision, announces that the weapons inspections teams will soon be on their way. President Bush remains skeptical, saying the U.S. will have zero tolerance for deceit on Saddam's part. Osama bin Laden reemerges in the news with an audio tape warning America and its allies of further violence. Bush administration officials are nearly certain that tape is authentic. Bin Laden lives. American Catholic bishops pass Vatican-approved policy for dealing with abusive priests, though the measure fell short of what many lay groups and victims would like to see. We heard Tom Daschle worrying whether the U.S. is winning the war on terror. It's a changing of the guard in China. 59-year-old Hu Jintao is selected to take over China's Communist Party. And Nancy Pelosi becomes the first woman to lead a major party in Congress as she is elected House Minority Leader for the Democrats. Jack, the pressure was on Iraq this week, and Iraq said, come on, bring him in. We'll take the inspectors.
Yes, in an extraordinarily surly and argumentative letter with a sort of admission, come on in at the end of paragraphs of abuse of the United States for its persecution.
We expected no less, I guess.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
And then Kofi Annan coming out of the White House meeting saying that he's, with all of this success of Security Council unity, he's not sure that the Bush White House and the Security Council are on the same page even now.
Yes, he says that the Bush White House may well have a lower threshold for triggering war than the Security Council. Well, that may be a problem down the road if in fact zero tolerance means anything he does is enough for us to go to war, and the Security Council say, wait, no, we need more than that.
Well, Bush's words are still very tough, saying we will not tolerate deception, denial, or deceit, suggesting if you even deny you have these weapons, we will not tolerate that.
Yes, and some people were saying that the statement inviting the weapons inspectors back constituted a denial, was itself a reason to institute war. And also the administration has notched up the security, the military part of it a bit. They have said that any effort even to shoot at U.S. planes or British planes in the no-fly zones will be construed as a material breach. So tightening there.
Jack, I was struck this week by how by the kind of shrug that greeted the apparent evidence that Osama bin Laden is alive. There had been a lot of hope and speculation that he was buried under rubble in Afghanistan. It appears he is not, and yet that was no shocker to most Americans. It just kind of melded right into the news flow.
It did, and it reminded us that there's already one war on, and that it's a pretty serious one. A warning from the FBI against the highest tax possible against highest priority targets, petroleum, nuclear sites, as well as historical landmarks. Yes, Al-Qaeda is alive and well. Its leader is. And he was in that statement. He was saying, well, he was ready to use the Iraqi invasion, if it happens, as more sort of tinder for his jihad against the United States.
Wrapping it all up in one great big case. And then there's Nancy Pelosi. They're saying, I didn't become House Minority Leader because I'm a woman. It just happened so. But here she is, a woman, the first woman in that position, and with a great big challenge in front of her, putting the Democrats closer to the driver's seat again.
Yes, and putting them in the way of some history. I mean, we haven't had a woman even near going on a presidential ticket since 1984. And women now are one of the props of the Democratic Party, so high time. The one part of it that I'm a little worried about is that if the Republicans revive Jean Kirkpatrick's slur in 1984 after the Democrats held their convention in San Francisco, at her speech to the Republican convention, she spoke of the San Francisco Democrats. Well, that's an encoded word for anti-gay prejudice, and I'm afraid we're going to hear too much of that. I'd hope we don't hear much of that from the Republicans. One thing to call her a liberal, but San Francisco Democrat is code word for bigotry.
Well, and yet she is a San Francisco Democrat.
Indeed.
Jack, thanks
for
being
here. And we can say it, can't we?
And we can say it.
Because we don't mean anything bad by that.
Jack, have a great weekend.
Okay.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
Sets and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.